All right, everybody, thanks for coming. I think we'll get started. Jay told us to start a little bit late because I guess the breakfast session wrapped up a little late. So this is, can nonprofit news organizations save environmental journalism? We hope the answer to that is yes, but that's what we'll be talking about over the next hour or so. I wanted to start off with just some headlines, some of the unfortunately depressing headlines about our industry from the past few years. In 2008, CNN cut its entire science team. In 2009, the Boston Globe killed its health and science section. Also in 2009, Columbia suspended its earth and environmental science journalism program because its graduates couldn't find jobs. In 2010, the Wall Street Journal killed its environmental capital blog. In 2011, the LA Times laid off its environmental reporter by email while she was reporting from the Arctic on climate change. So, 2010, the Knight Center held a symposium, The Crisis in Environmental Watchdog Journalism. 2013, the New York Times dismantled its environmental desk and shuttered its green blog, while it kept blogs devoted to horse racing, award shows, leisure travel, and about 50 other topics. And then a headline that I'm sure many of you saw earlier this year when Kat Bagley reported that there were about a dozen environmental reporters left at the top five U.S. newspapers. So, you know, looked at another way, CJR earlier this year did a chart that showed that in 1989, there were 95 weekly science sections in newspapers around the country. By 2005, that had dropped to 34. By 2012, it was down to 19. You know, we all know that science is not the only way to cover the environment, but, you know, certainly it's a big part of where the coverage tends to exist. So, you know, when you look at the decline in science coverage, that often mirrors the decline in environmental coverage. You know, I think we all know this reflects sort of a crisis in journalism overall. It's not just about our area, but environmental coverage always seems to be one of the first hit and the most extensively cut, you know, for reasons that I think we all understand. It's not as sexy. It doesn't sell ads. It can be difficult. It can be time-consuming. Let's see, sexy, non-commercial, difficult, time-consuming. Sounds like a good job for nonprofits, right? So, that's what's happened. You know, there have been a lot of news organizations that either, like mine, that have been around for a long time, but that have really expanded to try to fill the gaps created by the decline of, you know, for-profit or commercial journalism. And then there are a lot of new organizations that have sprung up. You know, I know I'm going to miss some as I go through this list, but you've got Inside Climate News, Climate Central, The Daily Climate, Environmental Health News. You know, ProPublica does a lot of great environmental work. You've got places associated with academic institutions like Yale Environment 360, Great Lakes Echo, and SIA that Mary's representing. You know, think tanks and NGOs, you know, Climate Progress, places like Mother Jones that are doing a lot more environmental coverage, traditional magazines like High Country News, Sierra, Audubon, Grist, Midwest Energy News, Circle of Blue. The list really does go on and on once you start to think about it. You know, when I started making this list, it just gets bigger and bigger. And that's great until you stop to think about, you know, first of all, how many Americans have never even heard of most of the outlets that I just mentioned and certainly aren't reading a lot of their stuff? And then, you know, how many of them are struggling to find an audience, you know, going to a lot of the same foundations for funding? You know, I think there's just a question of, you know, is this a sustainable model for what we do? The Pew Foundation did a report earlier this year that said that nonprofit journalism is a growing but fragile part of the U.S. news system. A quote from the report was that most nonprofit news organizations are small, with minimal staffs and modest budgets. 78% of the ones that they surveyed reported having five or fewer full-time paid staffers. So the question, I think, is if nonprofit journalism is going to be the future of environmental news, how do we make sure it's here to stay? How do we make sure it's reaching larger audiences? How do we make sure it's telling the stories that need to be told? And how do we make sure it's supporting the great journalists who are out there, you know, trying to do this work? So in the next hour, we're here to solve all the problems of environmental journalism and the world. So, and it's basically going up to you guys. So, I'm going to ask each of my panelists here to briefly introduce themselves, talk about their outlet or their organization, and a little bit about its funding, the stories it tells, how it tries to reach audiences, that sort of thing. So, Sam, do you want to get started?
Yeah, hi. So I'm Sam Fromarts. I'm the editor-in-chief and also one of the founders of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. And, you know, basically the genesis of our organization, it's only a couple of years old, was a group of us who were writers were talking. It was actually at a conference like this. Over beers one evening, and we were saying, you know, there's a lot of talented writers out there who are just not getting the support to do the kind of work that we know we and they could do. And at the same time, we were seeing this media landscape, you know, that, you know, of reporters being cut, et cetera. And we thought if we could somehow create a mechanism to bring funding to those reporters and help them produce articles and then place those articles with publications, you know, we would be solving a couple problems. One is obviously giving the writers resources to do what they do, and then also giving publications basically, you know, either, you know, entirely or you know, at a portion, subsidizing the cost of this reporting because we're paying for it. And so we thought that that was a good proposition, but, of course, to do that, we would need to provide the funding. So, you know, so we had to convince foundations, you know, at the onset that, you know, to support this idea. And one thing that was going for us was, you know, we weren't trying to invent the wheel because ProPublica and a number of others, CIR, you know, were doing precisely this model. But what was different about us is that we were going to focus on food, agriculture, and environmental health. So really taking kind of a topical silo and really specializing in it. And because we all sort of came from that world, we knew a lot of the writers in that area. And so we already had, you know, relationships with people that we could, personal relationships that we could, and they were already freelancing, they were already, you know, somewhat successful, and so that we could sort of parlay that, you know, if we could get the funding, we had the writers, if we could get the funding, then we could get the publication piece. And it was hard initially to come out of the gate without any, you know, as a young organization. But, you know, once we placed our first couple of stories, it got easier. And so I know we're going to have other questions, so I'll just talk briefly about the kind of stuff we do. I come out of a print background. I know a lot of print writers. So that was one focus. And we wanted to do in-depth stories that others weren't doing. So we weren't going to, from the outset, we weren't going to do news because we weren't going to compete with news outlets. We wanted to do stories that other people weren't doing. Secondly, and more recently, we've been working with some radio reporters and going into public radio. And that's kind of, we've done a couple of those stories, and we'll probably, you know, do more in the coming year. And then, you know, if we have the right story, we'll try and go to a broadcast network. And also, we might go to, please use me. we might also go to public TV as well. So these are, you know, it's less, you know, I think it's less that we have expertise in those areas. It's more, you know, it's more a question of do we have the right story that sort of fits the audience of that venue. And so, you know, so we're trying to do all these things. And so far, you know, we've been successful on all accounts in terms of getting people coming to us with great story ideas, or us approaching, you know, great, really good writers with story ideas that we have, and convincing a range of publications to publish our work, and then also sort of stepping into to other, you know, broadcast, you know, radio and TV. And then the final piece is we also do some companion pieces. We're sort of doing a lot more infographics, and we work with an outside team that does that for us. And that's been really successful, especially on the web. And it's great. It's great for explanatory journalism, that, and slideshows as well. So we're doing a gamut of stuff, and we have two full-time staffers with our freelancers that include people who work with us, not just our writers, but you know, people who help us edit the stories, etc. We're probably, you know, talking about five core people, and then with the writers, you know, up to, I mean, we've worked with, you know, a dozen or more writers so far. So it's a pretty, you know, I worked in the news business for a long time at Reuters, then went freelance, so I'm kind of used to working in this kind of virtual freelance model. And it really keeps our costs pretty low, so we could devote a lot of money to the stories. And right now our budget's about $450,000. So we're hoping to, you know, keep at that level and maybe go up. If we can go up, you know, then we'll think about adding maybe a staff reporter. I'd love to get a younger, you know, a less experienced journalist that we could kind of train and sort of put, you know, to do more of sort of quicker hits, shorter stories, rather than our longer kind of in-depth magazine pieces that we've been focused on. So,
great. Thanks, Ann. Mary?
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Again, I'm Mary Hoff, and I'm representing educational nonprofit journalism. I'm editor of ANSIA, and ANSIA is a nonprofit online and print magazine showcasing environmental solutions in action. Our publisher is the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. We're funded just over half by IONE, that's what we call the Institute, and the rest by a foundation, the Moore Foundation, Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, and also a few private donors. We launched in February of this year, so we're almost 10 months old. We took over from Momentum, which was a prior primarily print publication, also put out by IONE, that had a bit of IONE focus. ANSIA is more of an independent publication. We have a firewall, really, between the Institute and the magazine itself at this point. We did this in response to some of the trends that Scott was mentioning. We saw the need for an independent publication that could pick up some of the slack from the traditional media and cover those stories that just had no place to go. Our goal is, in a nutshell, to provide influential environmental leaders around the world with new information, ideas, and inspiration they can use to create a better future. So again, our primary audience is influential leaders, environmental leaders, but really we try to reach a broad audience, and we do a lot of that through the way that we use design, the way that we use social media, really, to spread our message. We publish online 3 to 5 times a week, and in print 3 times a year. Our content is about 70% freelance produced right now, and we have 2 staff editors and a creative director. In addition to the print and online magazine, we also have an event series that's undergoing a bit of a transition right now, so we're not quite sure what it's going to look like next year, but we're working on that. And we also offer a mentorship program in which we're pairing emerging environmental communicators. We believe there's a future in environmental communication, so we're actually trying to help people coming up through the ranks who are interested in it. We pair them with more seasoned people who have been in the business for a long time, just for one-off stories. These are 700-word stories. And we just started that this month, or last month, in September. And we've gotten about 2 dozen applications from people who primarily are not communicators, but maybe have some technical background or some knowledge of an important subject. So it's been an interesting experience, and we have a lot of hope for that. I think, do I want to say anything more in my introduction or save
great.
The rest for the questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So we had originally invited Laura Turner, who is the chair of the Captain Planet Foundation and has been taking over a lot of the philanthropic work from her father, Ted Turner. She was planning to come, but had to drop out a couple of weeks ago. So Carolyn stepped in to fill her slot and talk about it a little bit from the standpoint of an institution that also does some funding, provides funding for some of the work that we're talking about here, as well as specific projects and things like that.
Yeah, so I'm Caroline. I'm with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, which is based in Washington, D.C. And we're sort of an agile nonprofit, and we basically straddle the line between an educational institution, a journalism institution, and an outlet. So we're about 7 years old, and last year we funded 85 projects and had over 250 placements in external media. So what we do is journalists come to us, and that could be documentary producers, could be photojournalists, it could be print journalists, radio, anything. We've kind of run the gamut. We've even worked with poets, so you know it can be a lot of different things. And they do a pitch, and they put their travel budget there, and we fund their travel. And then the idea is that it gets placed in external media publications. So now we've worked with pretty much every media outlet out there. We're expanding in Europe. We've worked with outlets in Africa and in India and China. So we're kind of going global. And the reason for that is we both care about the environment, but we also care about international reporting. And so we were really funded, we were really started with the idea that all these newspapers no longer have foreign bureaus anymore. So we were concerned that the media landscape was just getting more and more domestic, and we were really concerned about that. So the crisis in our name actually comes from the idea of covering systemic crises, not necessarily like Syria, but more thinking about water and sanitation, climate change, a lot of these things that are really not sexy to cover in the media. It's not breaking news, but it's really important that people understand about it. So we do. So people come to us and we fund the travel. We occasionally commission stories, but that's somewhat more rare. We do infographics. We have a couple of interactive maps out there that are getting a lot of play. And most of our that is Creative Commons. And we have an exclusive channel on our website called Untold Stories. And that's sort of an idea that for the things that can't get placed because they're not sexy enough, we at least have somewhere they can go. And then we, a lot of times, will have that content republished on different outlets. So, and sometimes NGOs will come to us and ask for that content. The other half of what we do is educational. So we work with universities, and we have a campus consortium, and they pay anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000, occasionally more depending on the model, to basically partner with us. And that money covers the travel cost for journalists to go to universities. So it's an honorarium, it's the travel. And sometimes it includes a workshop, or it could be a long-form class. It's a really runs the gamut. And then part of that money also goes to funding a student fellow who goes overseas, and with editorial support and mentorship from the Pulitzer Center, they do a project. So they have to pitch it. We select one, and it's another way of training the future, because we need to do that. And then our other part is with secondary schools. So we work with elementary, middle schools, high schools in the U.S. and Europe, and then occasionally elsewhere, usually more by Skype. And so we bring journalists to classrooms. And so the thought is twofold. One, we're looking at media literacy. So we're introducing these kids to what is good journalism, but also we're introducing them to international issues. In a sort of an interesting way, with at least a character they can relate to who's been elsewhere. And this is also another way that journalists make money with us. So we pay them for their time, and we obviously pay for their travel. So it's a kind of a twofold thing where we're both trying to make journalism sustainable by providing new avenues of funding. So by doing the educational thing, by creating ebooks, by working as an agent for them to try to get them in different media outlets and getting them paid, but then also ensuring that there's a market for the future for good journalism.
Great. Thank you. All right, so let's start off by talking about money, because I think that's that's the big question here. You know, since none of us are, you know, selling ads, or since that's not like the primary way that we're doing it, we're not being supported by the traditional models, how do you go out and get money for the work that you're doing and convince funders this is something that is worthwhile, it's worth spending money on? And then what becomes the relationship between you and funders? Are there ever issues in terms of, because we're getting money for this particular project or from this particular person, we have to do something in a certain way? And how do you deal with that tension between where the money comes from and what the outcome of the piece you're going to do is? Anybody feel free to jump in?
Yeah, so we started off entirely with foundation funding, and we knew that. I mean, the message you get from the start is what's going to be your other revenue streams, you know, going forward. And so we've you know, thought about. I mean, we know we have to reduce the percentage of foundation funding in the overall pie. And actually, we've been building up kind of a individual donor base. I would call these people sort of wealthy individuals who are interested in funding good journalism, you know, and also passionate about our topic area of either food, agriculture, or environment.
Actually, such people.
Yeah, yeah, they tend. Yeah, there are such people. We're meeting them. So, so that's actually, you know, so that's actually risen in the past couple of years, and now that individual base is over 30% of our funding. So it's not that the foundations have gone down. Actually, foundation funding has gone up, but we're trying to make it a smaller piece of the overall pie. And then the third piece we're talking about, we're actually going into we got a grant to do this, to sort of plan out our future, and we're trying to come up with other great ideas on how to raise money. So, you know, either events or, you know, there's a number of other things that we're thinking about. But in terms of the relationship with funders, so we've been pretty clear from the start that we don't take funding for any particular stories, and we won't discuss our story ideas with our funders. So they have, like, I've never had a discussion with a funder about any editorial, you know, piece that I'm working on. And it's really, so they give, you know, basically just general funding. And I think there's this fear that they would want a direct coverage, or that they would want a story on a particular thing that they're interested in. And there might be money for that, but so far we're not doing that. What we may do, you know, going forward, is take money in particular areas, you know, for say water coverage or climate coverage or something like that. And so we're kind of unusual, I think, in that. I mean, I know that, you know, for example, you know, other nonprofits take money for specific story areas, but we're sort of concerned, you know, especially since we're not a known organization, of having this kind of, you know, wall between us and the funders. So I luckily have an executive director who's really great at his job and loves to, like, ask people for money, which I'm not particularly interested in or good at, and he's really good at it. So I let him, you know, do that piece. So.
NCIA's primary funder is the University of Minnesota, and it's really good mission fit for a university. We're about educating, sharing stories, communicating about important topics, and that's very much in line with the university. So we kind of have a benefit right out of the gate there. We also have a director who is helpful with the fundraising. We have one major grant right now, and it's a two-year grant, And our job now is to find something more sustainable than that. We have had a few private donors who are very interested, especially in our mentorship program and some of the educational aspects. So we've been able to get some funding that way also. Ideally,
No, I was going to ask, Mary. So you mentioned when you started that there's you try to keep a firewall between the Institute and what you guys do. Sam's organization had a fundraising event a few nights ago, and I was talking with Finn Montaigne from Yale Environment 360 about this. You know, and he said even though they've been around for a while now, you know, the Yale School of Forestry is still like, why aren't you guys doing PR for us? I mean, is that a constant problem for you? Do you have to deal with that, or do they sort of understand what your mission is and why you're not their PR arm?
The Institute itself gets it very much. In fact, they recognize that this is so much value added in terms of what they provide to the world. And they also I think the folks there also understand that it wouldn't be the same thing if we were talking about the university. Some people at the university are still a little bit confused about why we're not telling those stories primarily. But overall, I think we've been able to. And we do brand. If you look at our website, ncia.com, you'll see it's University of Minnesota branded. But that's not the primarily brand. So we're kind of walking a little tightrope there is where we've come down with it.
Caroline, can I ask you, in terms of, you know, an organization that sometimes is funding these kind of stories, what do you look for? I mean, there's this wide universe of things that you could be funding. So how do you make sure that the things that you're doing, that you're paying for, are having the greatest impact, are different and stand out from everything else?
Well, I think...
And I'm sorry, and are those actually the criteria that you're looking for? I'm making an assumption there, but yeah. So.
I think it's interesting you mention impact because as nonprofits, that's one thing we have to constantly prove to our funders that we're having impact. But journalism is a very hard thing to prove impact for because you're not an advocacy group. You're trying to inform, and it's hard to measure that. But, yeah, so we are looking for impactful stories. We're looking for things that are, underreported. So we're not breaking news. Although sometimes we might do something that's sort of a spin-off of breaking news. Like we have a couple of reporters covering refugee camps around Syria, but not in Syria, but in Turkey and elsewhere. So we're really looking for somebody who has a passion for what they're covering. That's why we don't dictate what people cover. We want people to have a established relationship with the topic. We also, in terms of funding, we have foundation funding and we have private funding as well. And some of our funding is for issue-specific areas, so water and sanitation or fragile states or women and children or HIV/AIDS in the Caribbean. All of our funders have no say editorially. We don't talk to them about stories, but sometimes we look for stories in those particular issue areas. And so if you look on our website, we have these things called gateways, which are content channels, and those are sort of where we're looking for content as well. But we also take and fund stories outside of those things. But it's really looking for something that would add value to the newspaper, to the news landscape that hasn't been covered, that we really want to make sure that story gets told.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, the question on impact is a really important one because that's, something our funders always ask about, too. And so actually I have some slides on an iPad back there of some posters that we produced for this event in New York, which tries to quantify some of our impact. But I also try to explain to them that impact is, it's not like a straight line. So one of our stories that we did was on wage theft among farm workers in California. In other words, they're doing piecemeal work, but they're getting underpaid. And the story was quite in-depth investigative piece that took a long time to report and was also told in a narrative form, so it focused on one particular farm worker. And so that piece was, it ran to like 5,000 words, and it was in a small magazine, which was the American Prospect, and which I think has a circulation of about 150,000. And so if you looked at the numbers, impact in terms of impact, You know, it wasn't as certainly wasn't as big as if you have a piece on network TV. But that piece ended up winning a James Beard Journalism Award. And so, you know, it sort of came back to us in other ways. And so so I was trying to sort of think of our impact as kind of an ecosystem with a lot of different parts, and they kind of play off of each other. And some are more visible than others, but, you know, they all kind of play a role.
So let's talk a little bit about advocacy and credibility. You know, Sam, you were telling me that when you guys were getting started, I think you had a donor or somebody who said, why are you even putting environment in your name? I mean, just the idea of you know, environment itself is like controversial and tends to turn people off nowadays. Do you explicitly try to make sure that you are nonpartisan, not taking sides and issues, or are you going out and saying, no, we've decided that this is important, and so that's what we're going to put our effort into? But then how do you then establish credibility and that we're not just, you know, going out and advocating for something? We are reporting, we are, you know, upholding journalistic standards, that sort of thing. It's not just for you, Sam, it's for all of you, because I know it's an issue for everyone.
Yeah, it is an issue, and it's especially an issue, you know, with our media partners, and it's kind of a challenge. And we also do magazine pieces where the writer, you know, will make an argument and come to a conclusion, and that's typically what you do in longer, you know, essay and narrative form journalism. You know, what I say is that's not our conclusion, you know, as an organization. We're not going out and telling the writer to come to a certain conclusion. What we say is, you know, we think this is a good story idea. Can you look into this? Or they come to us with the same thing. And actually, in some cases, you know, we've discussed kind of point of view at the beginning, and in some cases, their point of view has like radically changed by the end of the reporting process, which is, you know, what should happen as you really learn more about a topic. And so we have to, you know, our funders really need to understand that we're not advocates of a particular point of view. We're not, you know, doing, you know, campaigns. But in terms of having environment in our name, it was like, you know, and the argument there was, aren't you going to turn off farmers? Because they, you know, they don't like environmentalists. And actually, for one, I think that assumption is wrong. I think a lot of farmers think of themselves as stewards of the environment. And it hasn't, certainly, we haven't run into any problem, you know, with talking to people that you know, arises from our name. You know, and I'm, you know, we're willing to, you know, I mean, anyone could pitch me on stories, and it's not, you know, if it's a good story, I'll, you know, I'll look at it. It's not, you know, we don't go in with an agenda. That said, you know, we work with some reporters. One reporter who's like done a lot of really great work on antibiotic resistance. And she did a story for us that this is the one I placed with ABC News that tied she's a science reporter, and she had seen a number of articles tying a resistant bacteria in chickens to the same bacteria that cause urinary tract infections in women. And so and they've tested, you know, they tested the supermarket chicken, they've tested the chickens in the plant, they have a genetic fingerprint that it's the same bacteria. And so you know, so we went to ABC News, and it was a great story with a health angle, a consumer angle, and a woman angle. It was like kind of, you know, you're hitting three major categories, and that was actually a really good story for us with a lot of impact. And she's continuing to work with us. Now, she's hitting pretty hard on this antibiotic resistance issue, but she has, you know, she's kind of following the science, and she, you know, has places like the CDC, which are now, you know, which are saying the same thing. So it's not like, I mean, she's you know, come to a conclusion in her work, and we're supporting that. And, you know, we're looking for her to do more, in-depth reporting on this issue. So is that a point of view? As an organization, I would say no, but I would say, yeah, you know, that we are supporting this reporter who I think, you know, is pursuing a line of inquiry on this issue. So.
NCO is not an advocacy publication magazine. The Institute on the Environment is not an advocacy organization. We do focus on environmental solutions. So to the extent that including that in our focus, that is something that needs to be part of our stories, but beyond that, we tend to like stories that cross boundaries, including disciplinary boundaries, national boundaries, boundaries in ways of thinking, and bring those together. We don't shy away from controversy. We're happy to bring in different perspectives and bring them together.
Mary, not to challenge you on that, but I mean, I think that there are some people who just would say, I mean, as you say, just the whole idea that environmental solutions, that like there are environmental problems that need solutions. I mean, there are people out there who that in itself is enough of an advocacy position that that they would say that you're coming at it from a certain point of view. Do you ever have issues with that or have to deal with that?
So you're saying there are not environmental problems that need solutions?
I'm not, but I'm saying that I know that there are people on Twitter right now who are saying that. So, I wonder if that just on the face of it, just by, the fact that we are choosing the issues that we are focusing on, whether it's food and the environment, whether it's environmental health, whether it's environmental solutions, does that on the face of it make people say, you're bringing a point of view to the reporting before you've even started on it?
We have not heard that from other people, mm-hmm. And my gut reaction to that is that by focusing on solutions, we may be narrowing the entire playing field, so we're not just, covering everything. But we aren't saying what the solutions are. That's the reporting. It brings us there.
You know, I think this is a really tricky line to walk, and in some ways we're advocating media literacy, we're advocating for good journalism, we're advocating for important issues to be covered, and we're educating the public. So it is hard. And for us, we are constantly focusing on the underreported issues, we're focusing on human rights, and with good journalism, you're trying to cover all sides of the story, and we don't tend to fund, like, we don't have any, we don't tell journalists to do anything. Like, they have a set of deliverables, but we don't tell them what to write or anything for their other outlets. When they write for us, there are a lot of times when I'll work with, especially our student fellows, to say, this is an opinion piece, let's make this more into a news piece. And so that editorial side, I think it's really important. And sometimes some of our journalists will write more opinion pieces, and it's not the view, it's the same thing where we say this is not the view of the Pulitzer Center. We're just trying to report the news and the facts as it is. But that being said, we clearly, want to report on human rights issues, and we want to report on the environment. So, I mean, whether that's a position or not, I don't know, but certainly it's an interesting line to walk. And I think with our foundations, sometimes people don't understand the difference between advocacy and journalism, and that's a case that we often have to make with foundations. We have to sort of educate them on the difference. And when they're talking about impact, we have to say, actually, impact is not something that is very easily measured. Like, I can give you social media stats. I can give you our readership. That's not the total impact. And so that's what's kind of nice about doing education as well, is we can get funding for that, and educational outreach is a little more easily managed or measured because we can say we talked to thousands of students this year or whatever. But yeah, it's an interesting conundrum, I think.
Have any of you ever had, I know that in a lot of cases writers are coming to you, but have any of you ever had an occasion where you wanted to work with a writer and they were perhaps concerned, if I do something for you, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to turn around and do something on the same topic for the New York Times or something like that, because it will be seen as perhaps tainted because I did something for a nonprofit outlet on the same topic. That happened to you?
It doesn't come up with us, and some of our writers work for the time, so.
Yeah, we're non-exclusive, so a lot of the stuff on most of the stuff on our site is published elsewhere, and some of the questions I've been getting this week is whether we can, whether people can approach us for funding and then also approach other people, and. Yes, totally. We are not trying to say this person is our grantee and they must not get money from anyone else. We work with a wide range of people, and some of our grantees have funding from all over the place. Like Ken Weiss, who's here, he has funding from – he's right over there. Yeah. We're not like, Ken, you can't work with anybody else. We want Ken to work with everyone because that's his expertise, and he, that's one of the things he brings to the table, which I think is really important. So we're always trying to, support people in whatever it is they can do. So we don't have that problem.
Okay.
That's your answer to that question.
Well, On Earth has on occasion had times where we've approached writers to do a particular story, and they've been somewhat concerned because we're published by NRDC. Usually I'm able to sort of squash that concern by very quickly pointing to the people who do write for us and who also write for the New Yorker and New York Times Magazine and, any number of other places. Andy Revkin, for instance, is someone who turned down doing a piece for us specifically because of – this was when he was still full-time at the Times before he had a looser relationship with them than he does now. But there are occasionally people who feel like the rules for their organization are so strict that they can't cross over to writing for an outlet that's published by an advocacy organization. So even though, as said, we sort of have rules to keep the journalism and the advocacy separate, but just the mere relationship is enough of a concern for some people. So
How do you keep it separate? Is it just a totally different team? Or?
Yeah, the On Earth editorial staff, obviously we're all paid by NRDC, we're employed by NRDC, we develop story ideas independently. We are going to NRDC people a lot and saying, tell us what you're working on, what do you think is interesting in the environmental field that needs to be covered, things like that. A good bit of our story ideas do come from interaction with the people at the organization. And there are times when we bounce ideas off of people and say, if we did this story, what are going to be the possible implications and things like that. Once we commit to a story, then that's sort of where the wall is supposed to come down. And the same thing, we don't allow stories to be read by NRDC staff before they're published. We may interview NRDC staff for a story, but we treat them like a source at that point, that sort of thing. So it is, as everyone has said, it's always a tricky relationship, but we've tried to manage it and to the point where you let the work speak for itself, and you hope that shows what you're able to do in your independence. So I want to open it up to you guys now. I think everybody knows the rules, but journalists first. Then we'll repeat the question for the recording. Go at it. Let me know. Jeff, you want to start?
I'm Jeff Turner from Honor.
Yeah, and I did not place him as the first question. This is not planned.
I guess this question is mainly for Sam and Caroline, but I'm curious if you have any insights to. And it's addressed to you mainly because you're creating content that you then kind of put out there for other people to take. And I'm wondering how you weigh, stipulating that you may not consider yourselves advocates. You are advocating education. You're advocating sharing information. positive environmental solutions. But so stipulating that, how do you weigh the impact of placing a story in one place versus another? Because it seems to me like, you know, the central crisis that Scott outlined earlier is that all of these daily newspapers in places where it really counts, we need to get that information to people, are shutting down their science and environmental desks. And while it's absolutely wonderful to get a story placed in the American Prospect or the New Republic or something like that, do you ever worry about, you know, the fact that a lot of the people who are reading those kinds of stories are people who probably already kind of think along those lines? And I wonder if, given the choice between placing a story in the American Prospect or in the local paper in Jim Inhofe's district in Oklahoma or Texas Monthly or the Dallas Morning News, that could actually have a greater effect on public policy and education. How would you weigh those two scenarios?
So to sum up Jeff's question for the recording, basically, for those of you who place stories with other outlets, how do you choose which outlets to place things with or to try to place things with, and what kind of impacts are you thinking about when you're doing that?
So we tend to let the journalists dictate where they want to publish, and sometimes we'll pitch it to particular organizations as well, or we'll do an additional PBS NewsHour piece or something, you know, with a print journalist. So for us, we don't tend to say, oh, we're going to only publish in the New York Times. We publish in the New York Times, but we also publish in Huffington Post or in Dowser, which is a social entrepreneurship blog. So being kind of small and agile, we try to just, it's like the spaghetti to the wall method. We're just trying to put it wherever it should go. But we also work with outlets. So we work with freelancers, but we also work with journalists embedded in organizations. So we work with the Seattle Times on the Ocean Acidification Project and with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on a paper cuts project based in Wisconsin and China.
Did those newspapers come to you, or did you go to them with those
stories? They come to us, okay. Yeah. And so in that sense, I guess we're just trying to put it in as many places as possible. And I think your point about where is the most influential publication is a really good one, because some people will read ENSEA, who may make a policy decision, which would be more important than putting it in the New York Times, and five people read it, you know. So that's, we're very aware of that, so we just try to put it everywhere. And it's interesting, you know, we had a journalist who publishes on China, and she published a story for The Guardian on fake drugs in East Africa that came from China and India. And The Guardian is obviously a great outlet, but we didn't ever anticipate this, but the Chinese government read it and started responding and had some things to say about it. So it's interesting. You just never can anticipate, which I think is another reason why it's hard to know about impact. You never can anticipate this kind of stuff.
Sam, you want to take that too?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is it's not easy to pitch stuff, so we kind of pitch a lot of places. But a lot of it's determined by the writer and the sort of what the story lends itself to. I mean, you know, if we're developing like a narrative story, it's not gonna fly for really a newspaper story unless they give us major space. But that said, I'll give you an example. So of what you're talking about. So we did a story on fracking and food, and it was tied to some of the early kind of emerging science of whether the chemicals from fracking are causing livestock deaths on farms in those regions. And some of this was anecdotal, but we had, you know, there was one paper, one early paper behind it, and a lot of scientists saying this is suggestive and needs to be studied more. So we did, you know, I mean, it was a story by Elizabeth Royd, some of you may know her, and it was a long, you know, 5,000-word story that we did for The Nation. And, you know, maybe that kind of fit their audience. But then we broke out. I knew it was kind of it could get more attention if it had a different audience. So actually, and not every place will do this, but some will. We basically rewrote the story as like a 900-word story that we placed on NBC's website.
Did you notice any difference in
yeah, and it got huge amount of traffic, huge. And it actually drove traffic through the Nation story. So, and it, industry responded, And that's not your, that's not that reader that you're talking about who's maybe more, more interested in these issues. And probably the biggest, just in sort of sheer numbers that we've gotten are, we did a slideshow with MSN and it got on their, on their whatever pops up on MSN, to their to the people who go to their site. And that slideshow got like a huge amount of traffic. And it was on food stamps. It's called The Faces of Food Stamps. And it was just making the point that the people who get food stamps are not sort of the caricature that's often talked about. Very simple concept, but it took a lot of reporting to sort of find the right people and find a range of people and get their stories and then be able to tell the stories in, 100 words or so and, have it work with this technology, the slideshow. And it was kind of a difficult piece to produce. But that got a lot of traffic. So, what I'd like to do is like sell the same story at least twice. And if I could do it three times, I feel like I've hit the jackpot. So.
Next, Robert.
Sam, it sounds like you guys are doing a...
Robert, I'm sorry. Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, no problem. Investigate West. Thank you for reminding
me. Yes. That's my job.
Sounds like you guys are doing remarkably well with finding individuals who are willing to give to you. How are you doing that?
Willing to give...
To donate. I think you said that your individual donor base is providing more than 30% of your budget now.
Yeah, you got to ask Tom, my executive director. There's committed wealthy people to environmental, issues, and who are probably more interested in it than. It's not that they're well learned in it. It's not that they have a particular agenda. They just feel like, that protecting our environment is important. One of these people was at our thing in New York, and he's on the Nature Conservancy board. Mm-hmm. So.
So that was an event in New York.
Yeah, and. It's kind of what I'm learning because I don't know this world at all, the philanthropy world. I never worked for nonprofit before this one. And what we found is that you basically get some committed supporters and they get their friends because they're supporting all their friends' causes. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a...
I mean, people are still reluctant to pay for journalism. That's why we're all in this mess to begin with. Right. But... I think if one of the things we try to do with the education side and with the events is that you need to support this. So it's a growing thing, I think, but it's definitely an educational thing, and I think events can be really helpful with that.
One thing I will say, though, is we weren't started like ProPublica, which was basically, one
giant donor.
Well, yeah, it was the husband and wife, who basically gave them $30 million to start and have continued to, I think they're now down to 30 or 40% of the budget, but it's still one foundation, and we've never been in that position, even among our foundations. Mm-hmm. So, and this may come up in the bias issue. I mean, you can look at, people can always look at your money and try and find, you're getting money from XYZ, and that means that, therefore, you're, tainted somehow. And so I think just because we didn't have one donor like that, we've always had to have a diverse base of donors. And I think that's actually better because we're less dependent on one and also maybe less prone to this, bias issue. I don't know.
Next, over here.
Bob Wiss, University of Connecticut. So I've got a big question. How sustainable is this model that you're doing? And how much can you really supplant the coverage areas that Scott talked about earlier where we've lost so much? I mean, are we going to be able to come back to where we were with the model? And how much energy and time can you put into this model to sustain it over a long-term period of time?
Yeah, that was the Pew report that I mentioned at the beginning. That was one of their big findings. I'm sorry?
Repeat the question.
Ah, thank you. So the question was basically, you know, how do you sustain this over time? How much, you know, energy, time, all that sort of thing? And then how do you get it to the point where it is taking over for, sorry, the lost coverage from places like, you know, that we were talking about at the beginning, like the New York Times, the LA Times. How do you fill those gaps? The Pew Center report that I talked about at the beginning, one of their big findings was that that was the real problem, is that a lot of these places get off the ground. They operate really well for a year or two based on an initial seed grant or something like that. But then they run out of money and they don't know how to keep going. And they're usually founded by people who are much more interested in the editorial side. So, you know, if they've got five employees, it's probably like five editors and a writer or something like that. They don't have the business acumen to keep themselves going over time. They don't have the fundraising capacity that's needed to, once their initial seed money runs out, to keep going. So that was what, you know, one of their main conclusions was that it may be great initially, but is it sustainable to keep it going? So do you guys want to address that? Do you have thoughts about it?
Well, we've been around since February, and we're still here.
which is actually better than a lot of these places do.
You know, it's a start. No, it's definitely a work in progress, no question about that.
No, I don't think that we should be looking to nonprofits to fill this giant hole. We are trying to get as big as possible, not in terms of our staff, but in terms of our budget that we can give to journalists. But that's never going to supplant, or that's never going to be the same as having, like, all these foreign bureaus or having the science desks. I mean, that kind of service to journalism is sort of immeasurable. To have somebody who's dedicated to that, who's on the beat. And, you know, we ask more and more of our journalists, I think, every day. We're expecting them to cover 15 different things. And I think it's not sustainable. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that we're going to be around as long as there's funding. And we've been around for 7 or 8 years now, and our budget is over $2 million, and we've been successful with fundraising. So I'm hoping that we'll be around forever. But I don't, you know, in terms of is this going to be the answer for all our problems? No, it's going to be a multifaceted approach.
Just to follow up really quickly on what Caroline said, yeah. One thing that is really stuck with me is after the New York Times green blog went down, somebody said nothing is going to solve this problem, but everything is. And I really think that that's kind of the take home. You know, you're not going to solve it. You're not going to solve it. I'm not. But I think a dispersed model is what's going to make the difference.
I do think it comes back to something that we were talking about a little bit earlier, too, which is about story choices. You know, if you do have limited resources and if you are trying to fill big holes, you need to make sure that what you're doing is going to have some impact. It is going to be important. You know, don't waste your time doing the same thing that everybody else is doing. You know, find the things that are not being covered. Find the stories that are not being told and that need to be told. You know, so part of it is just making smart choices about what we're doing, I think. So, questions over? You in the back over there? No? Yeah.
Gloria Gonzalez with Ecosystem Marketplace. EM is the news and information division of a broader environmental group called Forest Trend. And I've been there about 3 months, and I ran into a situation about a month in, and I'd love to get your take on this. Basically, I was working on a story, and I reached out to someone to do an interview. And there was a lot of back and forth via email, but she asked if she could see the story before it was published. And I said no, and I was firm on that. And I'll save you the back and forth, but the last email I got from her was basically, well, my organization funds this report for your organization, so we have the right to see the story. And I was like, well, nope, that's not going to happen. And so it ended up being a situation where my boss had to come in and mediate and basically tell her, well, you know, you do not have the right to give you the story. But it raised a couple of issues for me. And one is, you know, how do you deal with an aggressive donor like that who thinks that just because they give you money, they can dictate what you're working on and what you're doing? That's A. And then the other question it sort of raised is, I work with a broader group where, you know, they're not journalists. They don't understand the rules that we abide by. So how do you sort of reconcile where you're trying to hold a journalistic line here and you're working with people who don't understand the rules and really don't care about them and may make other arrangements, you know, with these organizations that they're getting funding from?
So to summarize, I guess the question is, there was an occasion where a journalist had a request from a donor who was connected to the organization that she's writing for to see a story in advance. There was pushback on that, but how do you maintain those boundaries? And particularly when you are working with people who are not journalists, don't have a journalistic background, don't understand the journalistic values, and don't understand why the things that we do are important. Don't want to deal with it?
I'll take that on, sure. We've been fortunate to not run into that specific situation yet. My gut reaction is that's why we have our firewall, and we're real explicit about that, that no, we are published by, but not a spokespiece for the Institute on the Environment. If I had to get, you know, if I got pushback on that, I think I'd do the best I could to explain to the funder that this is the value of this publication, is that it is independent, and that's how it can get the word out to the extent that it does. So we are providing value by saying no to your request.
But that's where contracts might come in handy, too, like a contractual language saying you have no editorial control or you're not able to see the stories before.
Well, yeah, to follow up, one of the things that she had said is that she, I don't know why she thought this, but she said, well, our contract, our donor agreement with the organization gives us the right to use stories. And that turned out not to be the case, but it was one of those situations where we actually had to go back to the contract and look at the language to make sure, and we could go back to her and say, no, you don't have that right.
Well, that's the value of having it written down. Yeah.
I mean, to me, it just sounds like she didn't really want to talk to you. You know, yeah, we haven't run into that with donors. We're pretty explicit about, you know, we're a journalistic organization. Most of our funders, our funders understand that.
John, you wanted to ask something?
Yeah. I'm John Claff, freelancer from Maine. We had a situation in Maine where we almost lost one of our big papers, the Portland Press Herald, and a billionaire financier bought it. Of course, that happened. Washington Post, Jeff Bezos bought that. It's kind of a return to the patronage model. How is that corporate patronage model different from the nonprofit patronage model?
So the question is, with billionaires buying up newspapers and things like that, how is the idea of the corporate patronage model different from the nonprofit model we've been talking about here? Anybody have thoughts on that?
I'm not sure it is. I mean, I think the newspaper industry has always had people who have owned it. Like, we're a Pulitzer Center. The Pulitzer family always owned a billion things. And there's still newspaper families out there. They're fewer and fewer. So I think the question has always been, I mean, for the last 200 years, how do you maintain that independence? And Jeff Bezos says he's really interested in maintaining the independence. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have to care about media literacy, is people have to understand that independent journalism is important. And one of the things I have faith in is that if Jeff Bezos decided, okay, we're only going to cover Amazon stories in the Washington Post, I'm pretty confident that most of the Washington Post staff would walk. You know, I think that, well, maybe not most, but I think some would. You know,
enough to get attention, right?
And I think, you know, and that's one of the things where this is such an important important role for society. And I think a lot of us feel that we have this important thing. And so, I mean, maybe it's not a perfect system where we're relying on our own sort of feeling to maintain that integrity, but I think it's somewhat the same.
Yeah, I think the one big difference is that, you know, I think they've got to figure out how to make a profit someday. We can't make a profit, because if we consistently made a profit, then we wouldn't be a nonprofit.
My name is Judy Davis. I'm from Salt Lake City. And the question I have is, has anyone explored how public funding can be integrated into some of the work that you guys are doing and trying to finance? And if there's anyone out there that anyone's aware of working on, how do you help the public be involved in the news coverage that they're getting for the environmental news?
So the question is about public funding and if there are ways to get the public more involved in the type of journalism we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean there have been Kickstarter campaigns for particular projects, and I think ProPublica did that. We've talked about that. The problem that we see it is you really need a lot of you really need to devote a lot of time to kind of promoting your campaign. And in fact, like almost a full-time person. And to us, the economics of that just doesn't really make sense for, you know, unless you get a huge number of people, you know, who are going to, I mean, it's going to be small donations. And you're going to devote a lot of time to getting a lot of small donations. And right now, we just think it would be better spending that time trying to get big donations.
Right.
If you're talking public as in public funding, as a university, we do have government funding trickling down to us. I think our ideal funding situation would be to have a Kickstarter kind of thing for people who believe in what we're doing, believe that we have important messages that need to go out to key decision makers around the world, and are willing, so that we wouldn't be funded by people who are necessarily receiving or using our services, reading our magazine, but by people who know that's an important function. If we could go 100%, I think that would be the ideal model.
We tried an Indiegogo campaign and it failed miserably. And as the person in charge of that, I feel that very, very keenly. But we have had Kickstarter campaigns that worked really well for like documentaries, something with a very clear product in the end. And so that's, I think, something that journalists can really use Kickstarter and Indiegogo for. If you have a clear product that speaks to it, and the documentary that really worked was about homophobia in Jamaica, so a lot of people felt very passionately about that and tried to make that come to light. In terms of public funding from the government, we don't take any government funding. I guess maybe we could on the educational side, but so far we haven't, and I'm not sure how that would work.
So we should be wrapping up right now, but we started late, so and we're going into a coffee break anyway. So if you want to stick around, great. If you want to head out, that's fine too. So we get you over here and then over here. Yeah.
I just have some mechanics type questions for those publications or those groups that you're talking about. Are there any places? Articles. Do you do that after the article comes in? You see what it's like, and you figure out who it would go for. Or do you have to already have gotten a bite from a news organization that says, "Yeah, I'm interested in that," before you go ahead and fund that work? And then I was also curious, related to what Scott had asked y'all before, whether you get news organizations that say, "No, we just won't accept anything from you because you're a nonprofit," and feel that you have an angle.
So the question has to do with placing stories in other outlets. First of all, do you assign a story before you found an outlet for it? And second of all, do you ever have outlets that say, you know, not even about a specific story, but just we're not going to work with you because of the way you're funded and the way you're set up?
Yeah, it's a kind of a two-part question. So the way we work is ideally we get a publication involved as soon as we can, and to sort of hook that publication, we do what, you know, freelancers always do, is we send a pitch. What's different about what we do is that we help the writers develop the pitch. In other words, we give support, like an initial research research funding that may involve travel to really investigate whether there's a story here. And that money can be used for them to really develop a targeted pitch for a particular publication that we're thinking about, you know. And then we have a contract for that, and then we approach the publication or outlet, and if they go for the story, then we do a separate contract with the writer for the story itself. And I think only once have we gone ahead and done the whole. I really don't want to do stories that aren't placed. So, that said, there's a lot of different ways that a lot of different forms that a particular story could take. That could lead to placement in a lot of different venues. So then we do a contract for the story itself, and we work closely with the publication. We'll usually take a story through a first draft edit, and in some cases we'll edit it further, you know, based on discussions with the publication. And in a sense, they're sort of outsourcing their editorial to us. But in other cases, they'll just take it over. And that's fine as long as we kind of see the final, you know, final draft and discuss it.
You know? What? You want to read a final draft?
and the second part of the question was...
Remind us, the second part of the question was...
Yeah, and I don't think that's necessarily because we're a nonprofit, and I don't. I think some of it is caution about, you know, are we an advocacy group, et cetera. But frankly, you know what? My latest thinking is I think a lot of news organizations are starting to view these nonprofits as competition. And I mean, places like ProPublica are doing such great work that I think other places are frankly cautious about working with them, because it's like, why give them, credibility when they're basically taking some of our turf? So it's that old sort of news competition thing again. And I think we've tried to work with some places which flat out say we don't work with outsiders, you know, and they're just not gonna. And I think it comes down to that whole issue. So you need the right situation.
For us, it's both. We work with people who don't have any commitments yet, and then we work with them to place it. Or sometimes it'll be like the Seattle Times coming to us, and they have the whole idea. Or sometimes somebody will have a story, and we'll say, oh, this will be great also for radio, and we'll send a radio journalist with them. So it runs the gamut. For the second part of the question, no, we haven't had anybody do that, because we're not, like, our name is just Pulitzer Center, you know, so it's not really, nobody's like, oh, what point of view do you have? But we have had issues with crediting, so we always want, like, funded by the Pulitzer Center somewhere, or in part funded by the Pulitzer Center somewhere, and some outlets are less excited about that. They want the funding, but they don't want to put the credit on. As we get older and older, that's less and less of an issue. And now I think it's been a long process, and we have to always remind outlets, you know, hey, remember us. But it's getting to be less and less of an issue. But for us, for the competitiveness side, we are one of the advantages that we're driving traffic to their site. Like, when we do our social media and outreach, we're saying, hey, go look at it on Seattle Times. We have everything on our site as an archive, so especially for teachers to use. But, I think they were wary of it, but I think maybe people are now starting to get a little more comfortable with the idea that we're not trying to be an outlet that competes with them. But it's definitely a tricky area.
Yeah, and that's we're not an outlet either. We have a website, but it's really for our writers, our funders. You know, it's not for readers particularly.
Yeah.
So I'm Kat
Bagley
with Inside Climate. I know that, you know, Sam and Caroline, you guys place your stories, but there's a lot of nonprofit insights that show up. So
you know, we hit a wall where most of the people coming to the sites are people that are inherently interested in this. How do we break that line and start getting a broader audience to get these stories?
Yeah, great question. Basically, for outlets that aren't doing what we were just talking about, placing stories with other news organizations, but are actually trying to increase their own traffic, grow their own readership. I just said grow in that way, but increase their own readership. How do you do that? How do we get to the point where we're reaching a bigger audience? Mary, you want to take this?
Yeah, I have a couple of ideas on that. We rely heavily on social media to get the word out. I mean, we don't have the name recognition where people actually say, oh, I wonder what's at NCIA today. But through sharing through Twitter and Facebook, we're hoping that brings in new audiences. We also have our content is all essentially words, not the images necessarily. The content is Creative Commons accessible. So we do try to work with other outlets to either co-publish or republish and stretch our boundaries that way.
I think that's where having somebody on staff who's marketing or, you know, who's a business person is really helpful because they might not be your target audience, so you can say, oh, hey, what would make you read this? And that's where headlines really come into play, especially with social media. You could even go like the Upworthy route where you're just like, hey, check out this person, which I don't want to do, but, you know, you can. It's very effective. But also I think this is where infographics are really great because the things that are shared on social media that get sort of outside your target audience tend to be sort of infographics, photos. Our photo journalists that we work with, like those photos get people from like Reddit who could care less about, I mean, not that Redditors don't care about the world, they do, but they might not have ever read a story about child labor in Burkina Faso before, but they see this amazing photo and they're like, oh, I'm going to read this, you know. So I think that is a very good reason to have graphic people and photo journalists on staff or around.
My name is Bear Gavra. I'm a freelance photographer and scripts fellow in environmental journalism. This is a question for you, Caroline, but anyone, feel free to jump in if you have thoughts. As I've had a travel grant from the Pulitzer Center, I've had one from the SEJ, and without it, wouldn't be able to do international work. The challenge that I often face, and some of this may be due to being a photographer and people want to pay less and less for photography these days, but
it's not just photography.
I guess my question is about how do we make it sustainable for those of us producing the work? Because we can't do it without the travel funding. We're doing stories we're passionate about, but we're barely making anything on the back end often. And so it's I wonder if you guys are having some of those discussions. And I know Pulitzer Center does try and help out as much as possible on the back end by lining up speaking engagements and educational stuff and things like that. But I do wonder if that's part of the discussion. Like, if you guys get enough funding someday, will you be able to start giving a stipend to reporters or photographers, and you know, if anyone has a problem.
Yeah, great question from a freelancer. Basically, how do we make this sustainable for the journalists, the people out there actually doing the work, you know, so that they can continue to make a living and do the great work that they do and that we all need.
Yeah, that's actually something that comes up a lot because when the Pulitzer Center was originally started, we thought that outlets would still pay, you know, reasonable rates, but pay rates are stagnant. So it's something we are constantly thinking of, whether we should pay stipends, whether we should pay for content, not just travel. And different grants are different. So, you know, because we don't have set rules, sometimes we do something like that, or we maybe give a stipend or something. So it's something we're always talking about. We're trying to be flexible on. But since we're not an outlet, it's just very confusing sometimes to figure out, which I'm sure you all have, or you know, you probably have the same sort of thing. But yeah, that is why we do the educational side, at least, because you can get, we give honorarium for that. We are doing ebooks now, and that is not going to be enough for anybody to retire off of, but we're hoping that that market grows. So we and then events also. So we're trying, but if anybody has any ideas, we're always open to that.
Yeah, I mean, we're confronting situations where, you know, publications are paying very little for work to the freelance, you know, for a freelancer. And so we're trying to, in a lot of cases, we, you know, augment what they'll pay for a piece. We had a case of a reporter who was working, you know, it was a complicated toxicology story. And it took her, you know, a few months to do the story. And I think the publication paid like $700. So we ended up, and we had a contract with her beforehand. So, I mean, she ended up making a decent amount based on the per word, you know, per word rate, and, you know, and travel and everything else. And in the end, you know, the $500 was like, you know, lunch money. It was not, you know, it was not. And so we run into that a lot, but that's kind of what, you know, that's kind of how we work. So. We have one writer who's kind of on a regular contract with us, but otherwise they're just freelancers. And although, I mean, I was a freelancer, I know what it's like. So, you know, I say that we pay our people fairly, but you know, if you're going to do a story with us, it's going to be a finite amount of time. We're not going to, you know, it's not like an annual wage or anything like that. Yeah, yeah.
So I got the cutoff from Jay, but I will take one last question, and then yeah. So let's keep it quick.
As a follow-up to this question, we have gotten grants for to help us pay a writer to do travel, and they'll pay for document copy duplication and things like that, but they won't pay for a stipend. They will not include anything for stipend. And so, are there any sources out there, any grants?
I think the answer may be right there in the second row, actually. Yeah, I'm sorry. Anybody else have anything on that? Or, yeah. The question was about getting stipends for journalists, and she mentioned that Manga Bay is doing that for what were you saying? It was 15,000. Is that right? So, yeah. Anybody else want to take that before we wrap
up? We're actually in talks with Manga Bay to try to think about stuff like that. Knight Foundation sometimes does special calls. And it's something we'll investigate. So, yeah.
Great. Well, we should wrap up. So thank you all for being here, and thanks to my panel for the great discussion. Really appreciate it.